Game on 2FM. With Green Firm, a nourishing addition to any sandwich, salad, stir fry or snack. Natural protein, your way.
Cara Stewart, who was covering for Jenny Green this afternoon. January is gone. It's Monday the 1st of February and this is Game On.
Coming up today, Premier League latest, League of Ireland fixtures, Irish giant killers in the SPL and it's transfer deadline day.
11 o'clock. The hour we've been waiting for. And Beckham's in Paris. Balotelli is in Milan. Odom Wingy is heading back, we think, to West Brom.
Yeah, we've Fergal Brennan, Stephen Kelly and St Mirren's Jamie McGrath all to come on football. Plus, we'll have Greg Allen on his take on Patrick Reid's version of the rules of golf.
When you're out there and you are playing, you rely on whether it's volunteers, your other opponents and the rules officials to make the right calls. And we felt like we did that and the rules officials felt like they did that at the same time. So, you know, at the end of the day, I was able to go out there and shoot a low number today and, you know, get the job done.
I would not put myself in create a situation like that. If my ball's been embedded, I usually will wait and call someone and kind of wait till everyone's on the same page, wait to look at video. So I try to avoid situations like that just for that reason.
Plus, we've our sporting highlights of the weekend, minus drop goal drama for Munster.
The ball was there, back in the pocket. It's Hanrahan, drop a goal to win it. Would you believe it? Would you believe that?
Game on 2FM.
Now, if you want to get in touch, you can text us on 51552 or tweet at GameOn2FM. I mentioned in the opener that the SSE Electricity League fixtures are out, and I think that is something worth celebrating because it is really good in the current time to get some fixtures, and they're not so far away either. They are starting on the 19th of March with the SSE Electricity League champions. Shamrock Rovers beginning their defence of their title against St Patrick's Athletic. Then New Boys Drogheda will be at home to Kevin Sheedy's Waterford at United Park. Then in Ballybuffet, you've Finn Harps and Bowes, while on Saturday, Sligo Rovers face Dundalk and Longford Town will host Derry City. So it's absolutely fantastic to have some action coming up. That brings us along nicely to our sporting highlights of the weekend. Ruby, what was yours?
I think mine was probably Shishkin in Doncaster on Saturday, Marie, in the Lightning Novices Chase. He's a horse with a huge reputation. Obviously, all the racing were, plenty of the racing was off. Cheltenham was off at the weekend, so we didn't get to see Paisley Park or the Cotswold Chase. That Cleve Hurdle has been rescheduled to Wetherby, I think, next Saturday, and the Cotswold Chase will hopefully be in Sandown next Saturday. But Shishkin was the star on show, and he delivered. He jumped really well, travelled really well, and he's in a really exciting horse. There was good racing in Ace as well, Eclat the Rear even. Put his name in the hat for the Festival Novices Chase. Henry de Brom H. Charles was ridden by Blacher Blackmore. He was really good as well. So a couple of good novice chasers were my highlights of the weekend. Dunners, we've heard yours. Drop goal drama in Treviso.
Yeah, it was.
I imagine Munster needed the drop goal to beat.
Ruby, they were lucky to get it. It was a really poor performance. There wasn't a whole lot to take away from it. But do you know those moments where you just need someone to step up? And the reason I picked it was more so on a personal one for JJ. Must have been a tough week after the Leinster, and an awful lot of people looking at, as they always do without halves, looking at the goal kicking. And he came on in a big moment, just stepped up and, to be fair, banged it over. It was an awful match. Munster went 70 minutes without a score. But to get a result, you're right, Benetton are really poor, really, really bad. It was a poor performance. But sometimes winning ugly matters, and getting a result like that was a bit of a lift. Leinster needed none of that, to be fair. They were incredible against Scarlets and put in a big performance. A big performance by the likes of Dan Levy, Jack Conan were impressive, but it was a young 19-year-old that caught my eye, Jamie Osborne from Naas. What an introduction to pro rugby. You'd think he'd play safe and be careful. The guy was leading up the line in defence and just so confident in his abilities. So a bit of a conveyor belt, but great to see someone like that coming through the club system, and he put in a massive, massive performance. What about you, Marie?
I was going to jump in there. I know Jamie Osborne. He was born right beside me at rugby club.
Do
Dad
you?
John and Mum Valerie. Yeah, I know him quite well.
Ruby, what
Jamie,
a player.
I know his parents very well. Yeah, incredible. He always was, even as a kid. And, yeah, fair play to him.
But just that confidence, Ruby. Like, normally in a defensive line, you come up, you're as quick as your slowest guy. But he's leading it out there because he's actually worked out the plays. And to see a 19-year-old with that kind of ability, I was quite shocked, I'll be completely honest with you. I thought, this guy's at the level. And look, you know, good rugby people, you don't put a 19-year-old in a big, you know, in a game like the Scarlets. They're quality opposition. You're playing against, you know, a really good team. You wouldn't put him out there unless he's capable. So he's obviously been lighting up training. And look, I think maybe at the moment we're all looking to the Irish squad and it feels a little bit the same. But when there's talent like that coming through, it is certainly exciting.
And Donners, what about Harry Byrne? He got an awful lot of praise from some big names after the weekend with Bod and Will Greenwood both loading his confidence, actually, something that you mentioned there about Osborne.
Yeah, I liked it a lot. Same with Frawley, and I think it's something maybe we're seeing a little bit. England did it when they won the World Cup in 2003, and England do it again with Farrell and Ford playing these kind of interchanging tens, and I think that's what they had. But Harry Byrne was incredible. He just bossed. He bossed the game, Marie. And what I love about guys like him is they don't moan and groan about not getting enough opportunities. They take the ones that are right in front of them and they play really well. And I thought he was massively impressive. It's really hard to single people out. Everyone, of course, is going to talk about Tadhg Furlong, who played 40 minutes. And when I saw him not coming out for the second half, I was thinking, is this an Irish call now? Could we actually see Tadhg Furlong starting? I thought if you want to get game time into him and maybe play him 60 minutes. But then when I saw him not coming out for the second half, I was there, maybe he's going to start against Wales. Because, you know, when someone's coming back from injury, maybe it's not a bad call to get him to burn the boats. Go out, give everything he's got. And then have someone like Porter, someone coming back from injury on the bench sometimes could be on after 5-6 minutes and needs to go for the whole game. Whereas Tadhg, he was impressive and put in a massive performance. But for me, the driving force behind Leinster at the moment is the back row. And I think Harry Byrne benefits from them always keeping him on the front foot. But yeah, he's a quality player.
So Donners, it is the start of Six Nations week. How are you feeling about this Irish squad now heading into the opening game?
I must say I'm excited about it. It's going to be tough, Marie. It's going to be the type of rugby we don't like watching. We're going to watch arm wrestle stuff. And I think we would have learned maybe from the Autumn Nations Cup and the tail end of last year's Six Nations. We need to be a bit smarter against the Englands and France. But I think there's certain capabilities there that we could exploit. I just think we always try to take them on the arm wrestle and we have to find another way. And hopefully, you know, when you've good people in around the squad, the addition of Paul O'Connell will hopefully bring line-out launch so that we can see the best of Mike Hatt's attack, because we haven't seen it so far. So, of course, I'm worried about rugby in general, but I think hopefully we could find some way to try to work around these teams as opposed to taking them on. We tried to take England on twice now. I know you have to stand up to the confrontational side of it, but sometimes you just need to be smart with the football.
So what will Paul O'Callaghan or Paul O'Connell even do so quickly for the Irish team? Will he work on James Ryan? Will he change the calls? Will he go with Leinster players? What will he do?
Do you know what, Ruby? I actually think maybe a changing to the line-out system isn't a bad call. I just look at it at the moment and it's so slow on the ground. The movement on the ground. He'll pick up all those small little details, defend our spacings, players jumping to the right foot, if you know what I mean, they're in the right spots. But the big thing about Paulie is his ability to actually go through roles, I feel. He goes through, okay, from this line out, if you won it at two here, I'm just taking someone, for the sake of it, James Ryan wins it at four, at the next ruck, who's clearing out on the left and right hand side? Who's first around the corner? It's the level of detail he probably goes into. So I think it's going to be tough though, Ruby. I actually thought this would be an easy fix for him, just knowing his standards, but it's probably bringing the confidence to the likes of Ian Henderson, James Ryan, Quinn Roo, the line of calling system there, because I don't think any of them has grabbed that by the scruff of the neck since Stephen Toner. And it's a tough task. I never call lineouts. It is daunting. It is really tough.
But even Donners, when you were playing with Paul O'Connell, you both came from Munster. You've mentioned four back rowers there: Henderson, Quinn Roo, James Ryan, and maybe Tadhg Byrne. That's one from each province. Does that make it more difficult as well?
Yeah, but what happens, what should happen is when you come into Irish camp, you should nearly share the calls. Or you would say, we saw your calls there to Iran against Harlequins 2 weeks ago. Let's bring that into the system. But I think maybe all the, and we saw it in the Munster-Leinster game, I think that the Irish teams are using close on the same system, calling structures and system as the national team, and I think it's been cracked. I think it probably needs a bit of work. We went to Bilbao before a World Cup in 2002, and I remember Niall O'Donovan just split all the forwards and he said, go now and come up with new four-mans, new five-mans, new six-mans and new full-man lineouts, and we're going to run them against each other and we're going to come up with a brand new lineout menu. And that actually served us probably 5-6 years by being able to do that. So I think every team moves and evolves, and I think it's time for the Irish lineout to evolve, because to be honest with you, I think it's been stagnant since Devon ran it. And to be fair, he always backed his ability, and that's what Paul had. We'd go into line-out and Paul was able to always hit the winner, but when it came to the moment, he was able to win the most important ball on him, even if he was marked, and that really matters.
It's interesting, Donica, because we haven't really seen a kind of a clear game plan of what this Ireland team are trying to do. There is a huge amount of focus on the coaches and has been over the last few weeks and the lead into this opening game. And Mike Catt is someone that you mentioned a little bit earlier. Like, what can he do? How can he make an impact?
It's been tough for him, Marie, because if you look at rugby now, I think the majority of attack we see is probably from broken play, teams kicking the ball. So you'd have different ways to attack. Maybe if we can get to the edge or if we can get to midfield, how do we reload? How do we look? Sorry, I'm chatting really technical now. But the one thing you
can... Oh, we're interested. We're listening to you.
Yeah. But the one thing you can actually account for is launch. It's the most important. How are we going to make gain line? And it's how you judge coaches. And to be fair, Joe Schmidt was absolutely incredible. If you remember, I think it was CJ Sanders' try where Tadhg Byrne in Twickenham, where Tadhg Furlong makes that incredible play back inside. He's just done, when you score plays like that from the coaches, unbelievable work. It just, everyone lifts, and I don't think we've seen that a whole lot. Now, it's been tough on Mike Catt because we haven't been able to launch, as you'd say, because our lineout has probably been so poor. It's hard at the moment, scrum-wise, to gain an advantage in terms of launching off that. But I think, Marie, it's hard to judge Mike Catt's impact until we fix the fundamental of the game. And hopefully, I know Paul O'Connell is someone that would be well able for that.
So basically what you're saying is because the forwards haven't been up to scratch, the poor backs haven't been able to play.
Well, that's always what it comes down to, Ruby, isn't it? It kills me to say it sometimes.
Tis.
But yeah, it's
big forwards not doing their job. All they have to do is catch the ball quickly and get it out to the backs, and they're not doing it.
Spoken like a proper nine, isn't it?
Speaking of people doing their jobs really well, Ruby, Kevin Bruder at the weekend.
Yeah, some recovery in Ace yesterday. Incredible to get the height he was off the horse's back and to come back down and get himself back on. I mean, all his body weight was completely gone off to one side, which shows terrific core strength. You could ask the other question, how did you get yourself that high in the air off the horse's back?
How
would you get that high? It only ever happened to me once in my life, but it was because the horse I was riding was actually coming down on the fence, and so it hit me in the rear end and sent me up. He committed forward on the horse to go and jump, and when he gave the signal for the horse to take off and dropped himself onto the saddle, the horse actually didn't take off and took another galloping stride, so it hit him on the rear end and fired him up in the air. But incredible recovery, Marie. Incredible recovery, so it was.
But Ruby, the composure in that moment, you know...
That's not composure. That's just reaction.
Is that what it is? All of a sudden, race is out the window. You're just surviving there, is it?
Well, it is. It's like, do you really want to come from that height onto the ground, or can you keep the partnership intact? So he landed back down, luckily enough, over the horse. So his legs were on one side, his body was on the other. So at least he landed with some chance, and then he had to use all the strength in his body to keep himself on. Now, it was remarkable to watch, incredible strength, core strength, because it's literally with the ability to hold your body weight of your torso, being able to hold it up literally with your with your ankles. So it was an incredible recovery. So it was.
Donners, I'd say you would never hope.
Not a chance of it.
No, very different.
Actually, reminded we played it at home since Christmas. It reminded me of Buckaroo. It was the closest thing to it. It was like he was gone, but he did. You're right. The core strength to stay on there and straighten himself up, and then he finished in a fourth, wasn't it?
Fourth, yeah. €1,270 for finishing fourth. So I'm sure his connections were happy with that. Marie, we never asked you your highlight. We've been rabbiting away here for the last 10 minutes.
Right, and if anyone did miss Kevin Bruder's heroics, we just tweeted them out. So my highlight was on the athletics track. There were some really impressive performances by some Irish athletes this weekend in Vienna. Nadia Power, who we had on the show only a little while ago, she opened her season in record-breaking style. She has set a new Irish 800 metres mark and or record, and she has taken over 3 seconds off her own personal best as well. Kieran Neville also equaled her lifetime best of 7:30 seconds for the 60 metre sprint, and Sarah Lavin posted a personal best of 8:24 in the 60 metre hurdles. And this all kind of comes in the aftermath of the national indoors being cancelled because of the coronavirus. Now, the Euros are still set to go ahead in March in Poland, but it makes it really, really difficult for the Irish athletes without a national championship. So a lot of them are going to have to race abroad. Now, since then, Athletics Ireland have said that they're hoping that they might get some sort of an elite race on, races on for the athletes to qualify for the Euros and to try and work towards Tokyo qualification. So fair play to them. Fair play to them all anyway, heading off and going away and setting records, because can you imagine, guys, like a lot of them haven't raced in a very long time. So to come out and set personal bests, and Ruby, I know you're going to have something to say on this.
It always fascinates me about training, about preparation, all that stuff, sort of stuff fascinates me. And to watch them all go set personal bests off such a long layoff, you just wonder, are they tired after them?
Yeah, it could be a point, but it's peak in season, isn't it? You know, this is the they were meant to be heading towards Olympics, you know what I mean? So they probably tailor their programs now, and hopefully they can keep that going for qualification for...
Yeah, well, those three girls, like Nadia in particular, like she would have been on with us and said, you know, she was a little bit off in Olympics and then it was postponed for a year, and for her to come out and to keep getting better, maybe it'll suit her. Same with Kira, she's so young, and Sarah Lavin has been out of action for quite a long time, so they seem like the type of athletes that it's actually going to suit that the Olympics have been pushed back. So the likes of the people that were peaking for the summertime now might be at a bit of a disadvantage because they're trying to reset again. Yeah. I think it's one of those conversations that we could have and go on and on and on about. No doubt we have before, but
there's a lesson to be learned in everything.
Rest up, Ruby. I'm with you. I wish we'd done it more.
Okay, guys, we're going to take a quick break and we'll be back to find out if Liverpool have signed any centre-backs.
Game on 2FM.
Welcome back. So it is a transfer deadline day, and to talk us through all the movement and non-movement, we are joined by former Republic of Ireland footballer Stephen Kelly and journalist Fergal Brennan. Fergal, to you first. I've been away from the Sky Sports screen and the trackers for a little while. Do you have any news for us on Liverpool signings?
Pretty concrete, no. These things are more than likely to go to the wire. Liverpool had kind of hinted that there was a 5 or 6 o'clock internal deadline, but as we all know, on deadline day, those things are generally never really kept to. Deadlines are met and then broken. But given the current situation of them pushing for the Ozan Kabak deal and the Ben Davies deal, both of them, I would imagine, will be completed in time before 11 o'clock. Schalke have completed the sign of Shadra Mustafi. He's been released by Arsenal, and that was kind of what the Kabak deal hinged on. They wanted to make sure that Mustafi would be in before the German deadline of 5 o'clock. That's now been done. Kabak is now free to travel to Liverpool and finish his paperwork and his medical, etc. The Ben Davies deal was essentially done overnight, so that's obviously much easier. There's not the travel and the logistics involved. But obviously everyone's waiting for that official club meme or club gift that will probably be done at 10 or 11 o'clock tonight. But both deals are as close to being completed as they can. Both of them will be loans initially until the end of the season. Davies' contract at Preston is up, so Liverpool will make a decision on whether to sign him permanently in the summer. As for Kabak, they've got a £19 million purchase clause, which they can decide whether or not to take up at the end of the season.
Stephen, obviously Liverpool have beaten Spurs away and West Ham away at the weekend. Could you see a defender they would buy right now walking into the team, or have they got a makeshift back four together that they would stick with?
I think they do have a makeshift back four that they could stick with, but I do think that you bringing in an established centre-back would definitely benefit them, especially going forward. It's working well for now, and Henderson, I thought, was excellent the weekend. Phillips is a young lad. He's learned his trade. You know, he still gets caught for pace at times, and especially when they try and play that high line, which Liverpool do so often, that you think an established centre-back coming in would definitely benefit them, I think.
Stephen, we heard Klopp say that Milner shouted at Hendo, "You better be careful, because if you're playing like this, you'll be centre-back for the rest of your career." How easy or difficult is it for a midfielder to slot back there and look, play like Henderson has been playing for the last while?
You feel it's probably easier to play it in the style of football Liverpool play. You know, centre-backs now are expected to get on the ball, play, start everything off, split for the goalkeepers, and the midfielder is obviously going to be naturally comfortable in that position to go and get it. It's the defending side of the game, the reading of it, that will come as a little bit more of a struggle. And Henderson, I suppose, he's played right back, he's played right wing. When you see him in midfield, as soon as Alexander goes forward, he automatically picks up that almost full-back area, and he kind of has a defensive mind about him. So for him and the type of player he is, probably not an easy transition, but something that he could adapt to. He'd get caught out at times. It's understandable he's going to make a decision to run into an area, and that's just because you're not used to it. And also, in that position, the consequences are a lot greater when you make a tackle or you slide in, because you are that last line of defence. And he'll learn that, but you do feel like it's someone with his knowledge of the game and the way he plays it, that could definitely be a natural progression for him.
But Stephen, obviously Liverpool are having their problems at the back, but they weren't exactly flying at the other end of the pitch either. That seems to have turned a corner as well. Salah at the weekend was outstanding. I mean, Jones has passed to Shaqiri to Salah for the second goal. It was breathtaking stuff.
Everybody has been just talking about it. It was just an unbelievable team goal, start to finish. The break was electric. It's what we've come to know for Liverpool. You know, everybody talks about how good they are keeping the ball and passing it, but they're so good at playing the ball forward quickly. It's not just a hoop ball. It's always with direction and pace and accuracy. The first ball out of the pack was wonderful. Then the cross from Shaqiri, but the touch from Salah, like that, 9 times out of 10, strikers lose that. They don't control it properly because it's bouncing. It's so difficult. He made it look so easy, and what he did was so difficult. It was an exquisite goal, to be honest. You can watch it over and over again. Like, as Marie said, one of our tweets, I think, just keep it on repeat.
Fergal, Spurs really struggled against Brighton. We saw Gareth Bale coming into the team to replace Kane. We've spoken quite a lot about their lack of specialist 9 cover, and then on the back of all of that, Troy Parrott is back from Millwall, and he's heading off again.
Yeah, probably the shortest stint back at Tottenham he could have imagined, probably less than 24 hours. I think the situation at Millwall has just gone a little bit sour for him. There was high hopes at the start of the season that this would be the opportunity for him to get a bit of first-team action, get a regular spot. That hasn't happened. He's had a little bit of bad luck with 2 minor injuries at the back end of 2020, but I think he's kind of suffered from the fact that Millwall's results have nosedived in the last month and a half. And generally in those situations, particularly in the Championship, if you're in danger of getting sucked down towards the relegation zone, a teenage striker, a promising talent is not someone that you're going to turn to. And I think it's 4 league games in a row now that he's been on the bench, and Gary Rowett hasn't turned to him, even though they've been, you know, looking short of attacking ideas and definitely looking short of goals. So I think the conversation was had between Millwall and Tottenham that their side of the bargain of Troy's development being looked after hasn't really been kept to in the last few weeks. He'll go to Ipswich. It is a step down from Championship to League One, but I think the feeling from Tottenham is a lot more positivity that he will get his chance now, because Ipswich are doing relatively okay in League One, and they do have a bit more pedigree for young players and also for playing a more attacking brand of football. Troy's a striker that likes to get on the ball and create things. He's not someone that's going to want to be running onto long balls or flick-ons from a striker, which is probably what would have been the case if he'd stayed with Millwall.
Stephen, the energy in the Spurs team at the weekend looked like it could do with a few fellas coming in to shake it up a bit. They never looked like beating Brighton.
No, they definitely did look zapped. They looked you think the Kane almost is a bit of a hangover from that. I think him not being on the side shows that the team really struggled without him, and there was a bit of a fear factor there. You would expect someone like Gareth Bale coming in to give a boost, but it just didn't happen the way they wanted, and they did look a bit lackluster and energyless, like you said. They definitely need to improve. It's 2 defeats in this week has been poor from them. Against Liverpool, they put up a good show, but Liverpool were just were better, more ruthless in the final third than against Brighton. They were just lackluster, and they definitely need to improve if they want to see themselves getting in those Champions League spots.
Stephen, we were speaking to David Connolly on Friday about Matt Doherty and the fact that he has a real fight on his hands if he wants to get into the team. It doesn't look great for him at the moment, though.
No, I think I spoke about you guys before, saying that it was always going to be, not difficult, but going from Wolves and the way they play and what he did so well for them, he was a wing-back. So his defensive duties were not called upon as much as what he was a defender, but the way Wolves play really suited his style of football. Coming to Tottenham, it was a lot different role expected of him. And when you play with someone who like Serge Aurier, who is athletically really strong, quick. I know he's got a wick in him, but as an out-and-out fullback, he's very tough to dislodge, and he's got a goal in him as well. And I think for Tottenham, Aurier has done really well in some one-on-one situations. He's been very good this season. So he has got a fight in his hand. Listen, he's not going to give it up easily. He's an experienced player in this league, but it was just that transition from Wolves to Tottenham. It's a really different role, and I know people think it's the same, but it's not at all.
Fergal, any sign of Ole Gunnar Solskjaer doing a bit of shopping and renting, or is he happy enough with what he has?
I think based on his press conference this morning, he seems fairly happy. Obviously, everyone tries to read a little tick in managers when they're speaking in press conferences before the deadline. But I think based on where they are at the moment, obviously they've dropped off top spot and there's been two poor results coming off the back of the FA Cup win over Liverpool. But I think he is happy. We might possibly see one or two young players going out on loan, but as it stands, there's no incomings coming into Old Trafford. The biggest story is probably Phil Jones, who's been added back into their Premier League squad. United fans will probably have a bit of a collective groan at that one, given the fact that they have maybe forgotten that he was even at the football club. But in terms of incomings and in terms of excitement between now and 11 o'clock, United's not the team I'd be looking at.
Yeah, well, they didn't really have a great showing against Arsenal, but in fairness, it looks like Arsenal are going to be the team that are going to see a lot of players leaving. According to The Athletic, they're going to have a remarkable window of departures with Mustafi, Wilcock and Maitland Niles all on the way out.
Yeah, and I think part of this comes from the financial pressure from the club that's being put on Mikel Arteta in the last month or so, which is essentially to move some big earners off the wage list, and that's Socrates who's left, Mustafi, as I said, who's gone to Schalke as part of the Kabak deal to go to Liverpool, and some of the younger players, Joe Willock and Ainsley Maitland-Niles, Newcastle are in for Willock and West Brom for Maitland-Niles. We look at the Arsenal team and we're very positive about the younger players that Arteta has brought through, but Maitland-Niles and Willock haven't been amongst that this season. All the talk has been Bukayo Saka and Emile Smith-Rowe. So it depends on the situation for Arsenal. I actually think this is going to leave them a bit light because I don't think they're going to bring anybody in the next couple of hours. But from a financial point of view, which is what the club are concerned with, the dotted line on the bank statement, they will want these big players and their big wages out of the club, and Arteta has managed that. And obviously the biggest example of that has been Mesut Ozil, the longest running exit or the longest goodbye in Premier League history. He's obviously gone and taken a massive chunk of wages with him.
And Fergal, just while we're on Arsenal, some really interesting news a little bit earlier that Dennis Bergkamp's son and Mauricio Pochettino's sons are both going to be heading to Watford.
Yeah, talk about pressure. Mitchell Dennis Bergkamp, he can't even escape his father in any sense. He's got his name as his middle name. They've both joined Watford, probably going to go into the under-23 side for the rest of the season and then be looked at in the summer. But in terms of kind of wackiness of the transfer deadline day, this is two of the best examples of that we've seen in the last few years. Bergkamp Jr. is quite highly rated from his time at Ajax, and Pochettino's situation at Tottenham was probably not as steady after his dad left. I don't think he was going to stay much longer after his father was shown the door. It's an interesting one to see how they get on, but just the novelty of those names, obviously, particularly with Dennis Bergkamp's son being compared to his dad, is never going to be a good thing for him. But it'd be interesting to see how they get on at Watford. Watford are in a good position to potentially get promoted back to the Premier League. So next season we could be seeing a Bergkamp in the Premier League again.
Obviously, Stephen, Marie couldn't wait to get in there at the top with a poor performance from United on Saturday against Arsenal. They reminded me of the way they played against Liverpool. They just don't seem to be having a go against some of those bigger name clubs, do they?
Yeah, it was disappointing for them because for all they got themselves back up there in contention. They're still in a really good position now, but this is, I think, what we spoke about, the chance, the fact that you're never sure if they're going to be consistent. They show consistency to get back up to where they are, fighting for a top spot, but you always feel like they have this in them, and, you know, to go the way they did against Arsenal wasn't what we expected, and you want more from them. You want to show a little bit more fight, a little bit more desire in those areas, and at times they can be breathtaking on forward, but they're, like I said, they were lackluster, they're similar to Tottenham. They just didn't put up a good enough effort or fight, and they had not enough about them to kind of win over Arsenal. And it was disappointing for us. This was another disappointing week for them as well.
It was, and obviously City only beat Sheffield United by one, but watching that game, they were value for a good bit more. I mean, Aaron Ramsdale in the Sheffield United goal, he could have been man of the match.
Yeah, I think he probably was man of the match, to be honest. He pulled up some unbelievable saves. City, just, they do seem to be going from strength to strength, winning 1-0, not looking like they're going to concede, loads of potency going forward, possession, keeping the ball, creating chances. Phil Foden is being excellent for them. They just look like they've got their groove back, and I think when I was on here, Richard Sellison, but again, I just felt they were the ones that were going to push Liverpool or probably snatch it, and I just feel that they're great value for money now. They're really good. They look really comfortable, and as a side, they seem to have just got all that confidence back in the team and the manager, and they're just going about their business.
And Fergal, Leeds looked fairly comfortable as well, particularly Patrick Bamford. I know there was a lot of Irish eyes interested when they're watching him, but like a serious performance, 3-1 against Leicester. And I thought it was funny afterwards, he was joking that he put himself in his fantasy football team.
It's nice to see that, you know, even Premier League footballers make massive mistakes when it comes to their fantasy football team. He's had a little bit of a dip at the start of 2021 after starting the season really, really well, and obviously a lot of attention being on him and how Marcelo Bielsa's team would get on in the Premier League. He's a really good player, and I think he suits Leeds' style absolutely perfectly. If they need him to play as a bit of a target man and get players around him, he can do that. He's quick enough to run in behind. He's a really, really good finisher. I've seen so many goals this season that he's had ruled out by VAR or offside or whatever, and I think he's proven a lot of people wrong. Obviously, leaving Chelsea when he was young, there was questions about whether he could cut it in the Premier League, and he's definitely shown that this season. Leeds, I think, will probably be safe, and if they have got maybe aspirations of chasing down a European spot, his form will be absolutely central to that.
Stephen, his own goal, Patrick Bamford's goal, was outstanding, but he's passed to Harrison for Leeds' third goal. Could that be viewed two ways by a striker? Why didn't he take the shot himself, or did he do the absolute right thing making the pass?
Well, I think everybody's saying he did the right thing because it ended up in the back of the net, but I think from a striker's point of view, it's not often you see strikers make a decision like that, especially someone that's in good form. Maybe if he was in the middle of the great vein of form that he'd been in at the start of the season, he wouldn't even have passed that. But it was a great way of ball, perfect setup, and, you know, he is on different strings to his ball. Like I said, he's coming short, he's able to run in behind, he's quick, he's good in the ball, technically very good, picks out passes. He's doing everything that Bielsa wants from him and more, and I think it's great to see a player that people had so many, I think people, everybody thought he wasn't going to achieve it, he wasn't going to succeed, and they thought he'd be out of Leeds team after the first three or four games, but he's proven so many people wrong, and, you know, for him and Leeds, he's one of the standout players.
And Fergal, just before we finish up, it's a little bit off tangent, but it has been widely reported just before we come on air that Chelsea women's boss Emma Hayes is being considered by Wimbledon for their managerial role. Is there any developments with this?
In terms of the situation, not as yet. They made the decision to sack the manager after losing at the weekend, and I think she will be amongst the names. She will be on the shortlist when they're considering their new manager, and I think, based on her CV, if you look at performance at Chelsea, she's won 3 league titles. She's been linked with a couple of championship jobs in the last 12 or 18 months. I think she definitely should be amongst the names to being considered. I think it would be obviously a relatively bold move from Wimbledon to bring her in. But I think based on the ability that she's shown at Chelsea, her ability to motivate players, elite players, international level players, I think she's perfectly qualified for the job and would definitely be worth a chance. I think the situation that Wimbledon could find themselves in might count against her. They're right on the edge of the relegation zone. And just like in the Premier League, as we see with West Brom and Sam Allardyce, when teams are in that sort of situation, they do tend to bring in a bit of a grizzled, hardened relegation specialist. I think that could be the thing that counts against her. But in terms of a managerial CV, I definitely think she's perfectly within a shout of getting the job.
Okay, well, we will be following that, no doubt. Fergal and Stephen, thanks so much for joining us. Enjoy the rest of Transfer Deadline Day. Hopefully it'll hot up a bit, but they're not what they used to be, that is for sure. Now we are turning our attention to the SPL, because over the weekend, St Mirren earned a first away win against Celtic since 1990, and former Dundalk player Jamie McGrath has been a standout performer for St Mirren this season, and he joins us now on the line. Jamie, how are you?
Hi, Marie. How's things?
Good. Thanks so much for coming on. A bit of a mad weekend, I'd say, just given the excitement after beating Celtic. What was it like to play in that game?
Yeah, obviously still on a high afterwards. To go to Celtic Park and take all 3 points is something the club hasn't done in a very long time. And it was a great weekend now. But it's a quick turnaround. We have a busy schedule coming ahead, so we have to get our heads fixed for tomorrow. We're playing Hibs at home, so we couldn't really enjoy it as much as we wanted, but it was an amazing day.
No rest for the wicked, as they say. But Rangers Celtic is obviously the big Glasgow derby, but St Mirren's in Glasgow as well, so it was a derby game for you too.
Yeah, exactly. There's a lot of clubs in the Glasgow area, so it probably wouldn't be the most glamorous a derby, but at the end of the day it still is a derby. But we were going into the game, we kind of knew it was maybe a good time to catch Celtic. They haven't been playing what they've been capable of doing for the last 2 years. So we had belief. We went in and matched them up man for man. And we got the result we probably didn't believe we'd get. But it was Sunday.
Celtic, it's been a chaotic season for them, really. Could you get a bit of a sense of that when you were playing them?
Listen, they're all top international players all over the pitch, so they are full of quality and they can hurt you. It only takes a second for them to hurt you, so you have to be switched on at all times. But like I touched on, like we had belief before the game that this could be our day to catch them, and I thought we performed very well on the day, and I thought we probably deserved the 3 points.
Jamie, obviously St Mirren have 29 points now, but you're not the only Irish guy there. You have Joe Shocknessy, Conor McCarthy, Jack Doyle Hayes, and Dylan Connolly. You've plenty of support there.
Yeah, it's a nice place to be at the minute, Ruby. Like you touched on there, there's 5 Irish players there, and then obviously the gaffer as well. He's an Irishman as well. He's a Waterford man. So yeah, there's a good contingent of Irish lads there, which helps when you're there. Obviously, you don't want any clicks or that clicking into your dressing room, and that's not the way it is at all. It's a great dressing room to be a part of, and we have a really good group here going, and at the minute we're in the top 6, and it's something that we're aiming to try finishing, and it's something the club has never done. So it's a great group of players.
It looks like you're enjoying it, Jamie, and for you, 30 appearances, playing constantly and scoring 9 goals.
Yeah, I'm really enjoying it at the minute. Like you said, I've started every game this year, which is great achievement so far. And just touch wood, I can stay injury free and that. But yeah, the team is playing some nice football at the minute. I'm pretty sure as a neutral watching us, we're good on the eye to watch. And as a player, that's the kind of team you want to play. And you want to play in a team that plays out from the back and plays nice football. So it's great to be part of it at the minute, and we're going to strive for that top 6.
When you moved over last year, Jamie, there was a few kind of, I guess, eyebrows raised at you leaving like the best team in Ireland to head over to St Mirren, but it seems like your move has really paid off. Like you're kind of thriving on a different level now, it seems.
Yeah, I think that probably was the general feeling when it happened, but I knew that this was probably needed, which was best for me. In my development, I could have went to maybe a team or two down south where I wasn't really guaranteed game time or that. So, as part of my own development, I thought this would be the best place to be at the minute. Try to play as many games as I can, and lucky enough, that's happened, and I've hit a good run of form as well. So, yeah, probably looking back now, it's probably gone well so far, but still a lot to do and a lot to achieve. So, like I said, hopefully, I can just stay injury free.
You might have started a bit of a trend, Aaron McAniff now heading to Hearts.
Yeah, seen that today. Great move for Aaron. Obviously, I would have played against him over the last 5 years. And since, I think, 2016 he broke in, I think he's been one of the best midfielders in the league. So I'm delighted for him today that he got his move that he deserved. And obviously, he'd be hard on Shamrock Rovers now to replace him and Jack. him and Jack Byrne now, but no, I'm delighted for Aaron. It's a great opportunity for him, and fair play to him.
How has Glasgow been through lockdown?
Yeah, probably hasn't been how I imagined coming over this time last year. I was only here about 2 months in the place and into lockdown, so I probably haven't experienced Glasgow as much as I'd like to, but yeah, it's just the same same as back home. Everything's shut down, and it's just get up in the morning, go to train and come back and rest up in my apartment. So yeah, it's same as everywhere, really. Yeah, it's the same.
Jamie, we were all kind of brought up really looking at the big games between Celtic and Rangers and the big crowds and the drama that goes with them. Before lockdown hit, did you get to play in any of those full stadium big games?
Yeah, I actually got to play Celtic full house there. It was an unbelievable day. It was probably one of the highlights of my career so far, and had a lot of friends and family in the ground that day as well, which made it extra special. But yeah, they're the games you want to be playing in, and albeit it was a different result to yesterday. I think if we had the fans in on Saturday, it would have been made it extra special. Obviously, that's one of the downsides. You don't have the crowds coming in, but yeah, to play Celtic Park in front of a full house is something you dream of as a kid.
Do you think you could have silenced them?
Sorry, really?
Do you think you would have silenced them last Saturday? If you think about it, like, you were hanging on the end, your keeper was pretty much out on his feet. Do you think you would have hung on if the crowd were in?
Yeah, it might have been a different last few 20 minutes. I know from the first time I played there, the ball gets sucked into the net, but it was obviously a bit of a help for us that Celtic didn't have their crowd there, but we were comfortable for the last 10 minutes. I thought our keeper made a nice few saves, but it wasn't like a typical back to the wall job like you'd normally face there, so who knows.
Timmy, what's the standards like compared to the Irish Football League, like just in terms of level? Like, are you finding it much different? Is it better? Is it worse?
It did take me a while to get used to it when I first came over, but in saying that, I was coming off the back of a 2 month off season as the league finished in November, so it did probably take me a while to get up to speed. But yeah, overall the standard is very good. Obviously, you have your top teams, like your Celtic, Rangers, Hibs, Aberdeen, and then there's not really too much of a drop off that. But obviously, the top two are a class above the rest. But yeah, the standard is very good. If they're fair back home, I think Dundalk would do well in this league as well. Just from the team I played in, and I think Dundalk would have no problem in this league.
And just your own personal development, Jamie. Obviously, we've followed your career for a while, and you know we've seen you thrive under Stephen Kenny as well. At some stage getting to play for the Republic of Ireland, is that now a realistic goal for you?
It's not really something I'm focusing on at the minute. At the minute, my focus is just on playing as many games as I can, scoring as many goals as I can, and seeing where that ends up at the end of the season. But yeah, it's not really one of my main focus at the minute. Obviously, it's every footballer's dream to represent their country, and I've been lucky enough to do that at under 19 and 21 level. But yeah, it's just something you dream about, and who knows what's around the corner. But at the minute, I'm just focusing on my game.
Exactly, Jamie. Who knows what's around the corner? And I'd say if you keep doing what you're doing, you won't be far off. But thanks so much for taking our call, and we will hopefully talk to you again soon.
Welcome back to Game On. So, yesterday evening on the South Course in Torrey Pines for the Farmers Insurance Open, Patrick Reid ended up on 14 under, 5 shots clear of Tony Finau, Xander Schauffele, Rolf Palmer, and I'm not sure the man's first name, but there's a couple more of them joined on 9 under anyway. But it's not what happened at the end of the golf. It's what happened on Saturday afternoon that's really been of interest. And Greg Allen is on the line. Greg, Patrick Reid, when it comes to taking liberties with the rules of golf, it just seems to follow him around.
Well, it does. And in this case, it turns out to be unfairly following him around a little bit. But I not entirely. Basically, I think if anybody wants to have a quick brief description of what happened on Saturday. He hit his second shot on the 10th hole left of the green, and the ball looked like it embedded in ground, except it did so on a second bounce, which was a very soft bounce. Reid went across and he removed the ball from the pitch mark, as he alleged it was, very quickly, then called a rules official, and the rules official basically agreed with him. And that all sounds like it was fine, but a lot of people looked at the way that Reid sort of spent some time around the area where the ball had had embedded in the ground, or allegedly embedded in the ground. And then he moved the ball very quickly out of that, and he called the rules official in to look at the spot where the ball had embedded in the ground without the ball being in the embedded spot. So it generated a great deal of uncomfortable chatter, I suppose, more than anything else. And then it exploded on social media, as these things do. It turns out that, you know, in terms of the rule, he did everything that needed to be done. I mean, the rule says if you reasonably believe that your ball lies in a position where you have relief under the rules, but you can't decide without lifting the ball whether or not you're entitled to relief, you may go ahead, mark the spot and remove the ball. He was completely exonerated by officials. And so too Rory McIlroy, who had a similar incident on the 18th. So why was it that this stuck with Patrick Reid? It's because of guilt by association, guilt by history, you could say, because back in 2019 at the Hero World Challenge in the Bahamas, Reid was given a two-stroke penalty for doing something that was really hard to watch, to be honest. On the par 5 11th, Reid's ball was in a sand-waste area in the Bahamas, and this is December 2019. You know, it's not a very important tournament, to be brutally honest. He was leading at the time, but his ball was lying in an area of unraked sand. It's not a bunker, as I said, so he didn't have any relief from that, but he put his sand wedge behind the ball and twice removed sand from behind the ball. It was so clear on camera that it wasn't even a marginal call. Both times he denied that he had done so. He also said that it's your word against mine, but the camera didn't lie. And there was this incident as well, not incident, but this moment when Ricky Fowler, who's a real stand-up, very popular guy, very smart, very sharp, he walks into the press room in the Hero World Challenge and he sees the review of Reid's moving of the sand with the golf club on the television being reviewed by the tournament officials. And Ricky goes, what on earth is that, you know? And basically saying there's no case to answer. He's clearly removing the sand, and that's a punishable offence. So that has been following Reid around, as has, you know, some degree of cloudiness about his he was booted off the University of Golf, Georgia golf team, when he was an amateur. There was a lot of cloud around that as to why that happened. So this all follows him around, and you come to last Saturday's incident, and basically it's because the cameras are on him. And in golf, you know, it's a sport where there's a lot of honour involved, and if you've got a little bit of dishonour in your background or perceived dishonour in your background, you're going to suffer, and he did.
But when he walked up to the ball, he did ask the lady that was standing beside it, did she see it bounce? And she said she didn't. So to me, watching it, he kind of did make the inquiry, and I kind of feel like someone's pointing the finger at him a little bit unfairly, like you alluded to in the beginning.
Well, again, there's this moment when he takes the ball out of the pitch mark very quickly, and which is fine, I suppose, because it's within the rules. And it's then the time that he spends with his finger where the ball had been in the pitch mark, and he then calls the rules official across, which he doesn't actually have to do. He can deem the ball to be embedded himself as long as his playing partners are happy with that. But he called in a rules official, and, you know, everything seems to have been done by the rules. So what's wrong here? What's wrong is the way, and what is perceived as being wrong is the way that he spent time around the ball area. Was he doing anything with his finger in the ground, basically? And the thing is that is a scenario that wouldn't attach to 99.9% of players. But Reid has history. Now, people have been saying, well, exactly the same thing happened to Rory, and it did on the 18th. But what's Rory's history? Rory doesn't have a history with regard to the rules, except a very good one. Like at the USPGA Championship in Harding Park in San Francisco last August, Rory hit a ball, it was left of the third green in the second round, and some spectator, when they were looking for the ball, it was clearly a bad lie, some spectator stood on the ball as they were looking for it. And Rory thought, when he was given the relief, he was allowed to place the ball in the rough in a very good lie. And Rory thought that, no, that was too much. That was too good a scenario for him. He wasn't going to just place the ball on top of the grass, because that would have been a better lie than he would have perceived he would have had the ball been found and not stood on. So he actually got his ball and placed it down in the grass in a pretty deep lie and made bogey in the hole as a result of not being able to get up and down and not getting a good shot at it. So Rory's reputation is, he actually made the lie worse than he was entitled to. So Rory had this situation last Saturday, similarly on the 18th. The ball bounced once and his ball was plugged as well, and he got exactly the same relief. And Rule 16.4 exonerates both players. It's all about what's in your past. And in Patrick Reid's past, there is a lot of murk.
But Greg, when he lifted the ball up, thinking it was plugged and it wasn't, what would have happened if it wasn't? If he assumed it was plugged, but it wasn't, if he picked it up, what happens then?
He would have had to place the ball back in the lie exactly as it had been. You are entitled to check to see if your ball is plugged. It is not a scenario whereby he would have been penalised if his ball hadn't been plugged. Because there are times when the ball is lying deep in grass where you cannot see underneath the ball. So thereby you're allowed to examine the position it's in. If he took it out and he said, actually, it's not a plugged lie, he's then entitled to put the ball right back in exactly the same lie. He has to replicate the lie. It certainly cannot be put back into a better lie.
Greg Sander Schofield said, obviously, the talk amongst the boys isn't great, but he's protected by the tour and that's all that matters. Obviously, it's not a popularity contest, but it doesn't seem like there's great camaraderie between Reid and the rest of the tour.
No, I mean, this is obvious. I mean, I think Xander Schauffele is another guy, a bit like Ricky Fowler, really well-regarded, bright guy, very, very careful with his words. I've been in press conferences with Xander, and he chooses his words very carefully. So for him to say, obviously the talk amongst the boys isn't great, but I've given you the history that Reid has, and the history isn't good. And golf is this game where if you've got a bad reputation with regard to the rules, it follows you forever. It's a terrible thing to be lumped with. I believe that when Rory McIlroy was dragged into this argument or conversation, and he was dragged into it by Patrick Reid's Twitter account. I'm not so sure Patrick Reid was in charge of his Twitter account at the time. Apparently, Rory was really shocked, really, you know, very, very annoyed that he was dragged into the conversation, because his reputation, as I've illustrated by the incident in Harding Park at the USPGA Championship, is pretty squeaky clean with the rules.
Thanks a million, Greg Allen. You've cleared it up some bit for us anyway. But anyway, great performance from Padraig Harrington in Dubai as well. He finished sixth. That was definitely the highlight of the golf for the weekend for me.
Yeah, no, I have to say, with regard to Padraig, just a couple of things. It's the seventh cut in a row that he's made. He hasn't done that since 2012, so he's playing really consistent golf. And his sixth place in Dubai was his second top 10 in seven starts. This is the type of form we haven't seen from Padraig in quite some time. And he's getting a bit more confident week on week. If he gets that putter running on the greens, as he used to back in his heyday, you know, he could actually start challenging to win a tournament at 49 years and 5 months old. And
he could play himself onto his own Ryder Cup team yet. You'd never know, Greg.
I say that is fairly unlikely at the moment.
It is indeed.
He doesn't have access to the major golf championships or the World Golf Championship events with his world ranking. But his world ranking is nearly 200 places higher than it was last October.
Thanks a million, Greg. Game on 2FM.